Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Before we introduce this week's guest, I want to give a shout out to our Patreon supporters. Patreon is a great way to support everything Cool Tools does, including our newsletters, podcast, video channel, and our review website. This week, we want to give a shout out to Rel DeShaw and Thomas Off. Thanks a lot, Rel and Thomas. To become a patron of Cool Tools, visit patreon.com/cooltools. Our guest this week is Ramona Pringle. Ramona is a creator, journalist, and researcher whose work focuses on the interactions between humans, technology, and the world around us. She's a contributor to numerous media outlets, including tech columnist with the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and director of the Creative Innovation Studio at Ryerson University in Toronto. Hey, Ramona, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. I'm really happy to be joining you.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you join us and really looking forward to tools that you find yourself favoring and using a lot. So thank you for joining us.
So Ramona, you have a number of tools to talk about, and I'll just prompt you for the first one. Tell us about a ring light. What is it? What do you use it for?
So a ring light is sort of what it sounds like. It's a donut-shaped light, LED, that you use when you're recording videos. And especially if you're recording videos for online where it's just you, where it's just one person. And isn't this now the scenario that so many of us find ourselves in as we're working remotely, whether you're recording videos to share or whether you're just having a day long or day full of Zoom meetings and Google Meets, you know, we're all in front of our screens and we know that the lighting's not always consistent. My office where I work out of is so bright in the morning and it's dark in the evening. And even if I'm not broadcasting, you want to have a good, clean image to project. Now, my background is in production, and I will say 10 years ago, I was so excited because I invested for my production company in these LED lights. And they were amazing because they, at the time, seemed very small. They were compact. They were like a foot by a foot square. And just these, you know, amazingly powerful, did a great job lighting a shoot when we were doing interviews. I would carry three of them around. We could do 3-point lighting. But even so, even being these things that I was so excited about because they were more compact than what we would have had before, I remember flying out to do an interview and lugging this box, which was very, very heavy. I'm going to guess, you know, over 60 pounds, and dropping it on my foot at the airport before we were taking off for the interview. I'm pretty sure I broke my toe and had to get through this entire flight interview return trip with just this excruciating pain because they were so heavy. And so one of the incredible things about the ring light is just you're just dealing with this one light. It's very, very lightweight. And so it's convenient. I love the fact that it's easy. I think for a lot of people, especially now, because you're not necessarily a professional who's interviewing other people or setting up a formal set, but you just want to have that kind of consistency and that look of professionalism when you're broadcasting from your own home, most likely. It's so simple. It's so user-friendly and it's lightweight. So this is the other thing. My office is on the third floor of our house. I also do these tutorials called make-alongs from my kitchen, and I'll like to have it down there as well. So running up and down three flights of stairs is excruciating, but this is light enough that it isn't that much harder to do. So that's what I really love about it, is that it's simple. It's simple to use. You don't need to worry about knowing how to, you know, set up 3-point lighting and worrying about bad shadows or bad angles of how everything is set up. It's not super heavy. And it feels like for the way that we're all working right now, a great tool to have on hand.
So ring lights have been around for a while, and there's different kinds. There's some that are used for product photography. So they're smaller. In fact, there's some that just fit around the circumference of the lens itself. The one you're talking about is much bigger. It's kind of like for a portrait. Do you have a preference of the size of this? Because they come in many sizes.
That's true. And that's a great point. You know, some of them are really small. So some of them, you know, you walk or you go on vacation and you see influencers or, you know, I'm doing air quotes here. I wish you could see me. Influencers holding up their phones. And what's great about it is you do get very even, very flattering lighting. And so that's where you'll see them. The one that I have is quite a bit bigger. I'm holding up my hands to try and figure it out. It's probably about 2 feet diameter. And so the way it works is you can either put you could put your phone in the middle, or you could put a DSLR camera in the middle. I often just put my laptop right in front of it, and you just get that nice even lighting. I think that the origins of a ring light like this size, it was used by a lot of YouTubers, especially for things like makeup tutorials. You know, when people are doing, Halloween is coming up, Halloween lighting with the gore and making it look like you've got a giant slash through your face. They want that really nice, even lighting so that they can get that precision and get the detail. And so I think that's probably a lot of the origin of this size and scale. But it's also really nice, like for this particular purpose of kind of settling into an understanding that instead of having a meeting face to face, you're going to sit down in front of your laptop and log in. What's nice is just having that light behind your laptop to have something other than what can kind of seem sometimes like diabolical lighting coming if you're just using laptop screen light.
So what it is either it's a tube, but it's certainly a circle of probably LEDs inside. Mm-hmm. So they're lightweight and maybe dimmable, or maybe you could change the colors. And then it would be probably also mounted on a stand of some sort, or maybe it does come with a stand or doesn't.
Yeah, it comes with a tripod, so you can get it to the height that you want it. And it comes with a diffuser as well that you can put around it, so you're getting nice soft light, and it's also dimmable. So you do have the ability to, you know, make it super hot, make it super bright if that's what you need, soften it a little bit if that's what you're looking for, if you just want to kind of boost and neutralize the image a little bit. So it's I should have explained that right off the bat. So if imagine I'm sitting behind my desk, there's a tripod so that I can set it to the height exactly behind where my computer is sitting. I also have a laptop tripod, which does sort of the same thing, although admittedly, I don't use it nearly as much as just having a stack of books on my desk to get my laptop to the right height that I want it for whatever particular use that I'm doing. And then I can set the tripod to the same height as the laptop on that stack of books to get it to face height or eye height. And it's on that tripod. And then it's large enough that the ring of LED lights goes around the outside of the laptop. So it's not being blocked by the laptop.
So the general idea, as I understand it, of the ring, if this ring is large enough, basically it's a ring around your face. And what it's doing is that it's giving an even amount of light from all the directions around your face so that there's no one side that's brighter than the others. And that makes a very even and, in a certain sense, flat lighting that will then highlight your face beyond, in front of or instead of the background so that you could and then because it has diffuse and even, there's really no shadows anywhere because it's coming from all directions evenly. You can center your camera, but really you're centering your face in the ring. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And there are people, you know, there's people who have some complaints around it. You know, if you wear glasses, you're probably going to get a glare of those circular light donuts in your mm-hmm. glasses. I've heard some people say that if you're sitting too close to it, you could even get that glare inside of your eyes. And again, you know, this
is in your pupils. Yeah,
in your pupil. That's right. Yeah, you're going to get that reflection back. So it's not for everyone. And depending on what you're doing, you're not necessarily going to shoot a feature using ring lights. It's not going to give you what you're looking for in that way. But I do think for the use right now, where everyone's at home in front of their computer, instead of investing in a light kit where you're going to break your toe like I did, which is so heavy, just having something like this on hand, not an investment maybe for anybody, but if you are doing a lot of videos, and certainly if you're broadcasting, Even I think for teachers, it's a good tool because you've got that consistency. And that's another piece. I think so many of us are working odd hours. You may be recording something at 7 a.m. and you may be recording something at 7 p.m. And just to have that consistency, it's nice to have something like this to kind of flatten the difference of times as well. So you've got that consistency of what you're recording.
And so there are many makers and models of ring lights, even the large ones, let's say that 18 inches, which is about a foot and a half, which the prices could range from $80 to $300. Do you have a particular brand or model? Would you steer people to one side or the other? Does a cheap one work as well? Do you want to invest into the higher priced one for some reason?
Well, I'll tell you what I've got. I've got a Diva. Mine's called the Diva Ring Light. It sounds so cheesy to say a Diva Ring Light, but actually some of my previous lights were Diva as well. It's about $250. It's a little bit more expensive. I think you just want to make sure that what you get is coming with a tripod because that's really going to make it functional. Having it be dimmable is a really, really useful feature as well. And then having that diffuser that goes around it. But as long as you have all of those things, I don't know why you wouldn't get something a little bit cheaper. But I haven't tested out anything cheaper myself. But I feel like as long as it's got those features, it's probably going to do the trick.
Right. I do see on Amazon, versions of 18 inches ring light with tripods for $80. So who knows? But that does give you some sense of the range of things.
Yeah. If someone has an $80 one, I'd love to hear what their experience with it is. Although I don't know why I would need a second, because the whole point is that you only need the one.
Right.
Sure. Sure. I'm just trying to give a sense of the range of things. Mm-hmm. So that's really great. So you have another tool that you want to tell us.
Yeah, this one looks really interesting to me. A chained iPhone case.
Yeah, and this is exactly what it sounds like. And it's funny because I think that this is maybe the thing that I get stopped on the street about more than anything else. And just it blows people's minds. It's one of those things that if you haven't seen it, you probably wouldn't think that you need it. And it probably sounds very nerdy, right? Carrying your phone on you like a bag.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like a purse. So your phone, which these days is your wallet, right? So it's got your credit card and everything else in. So you just wear it like it was a purse.
That's exactly right. And it has changed my life in that I don't carry a purse anymore. And the one that I've got, I got for, I think, $18 on Amazon, and my credit cards fit inside of it. And so I feel no need to carry. I used to carry I had purse creep where it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. My purse was big enough that I could carry my laptop around in it, a mug of tea. Like, it was a large bag. And yeah. And so, there is that kind of creep that can happen when you are a purse carrier. But this is amazing because, yeah, you're paying for things with your phone. You've always got it with you. The backstory on how I even discovered this in the first place was that, I did a lot of remote work even before the pandemic, which means, I always had a device with me because I have a daughter who's going to turn 3 next week, and I'd be with her and maybe waiting for an email to come in with edits on something that I had written, let's say, and just being accessible, but not necessarily being tied to the computer was a way that I always worked. So I was always carrying my phone around with me, or I maybe had it in my back pocket. But I was always conflicted about it, and especially because so much of what I write about and so much of what I cover is our relationship to technology. I think a lot about kids as well and what we're projecting or what they're mirroring. And so I always had this kind of angel and devil on my shoulders when it came to having my phone with me all the time. And so there was a particular day, my daughter was about a year and a half, and I couldn't find my phone. But again, the little, I don't know which one it was, the angel or the devil, but one of them on my shoulders was saying, "Don't worry about it. It's good. You don't need to have your phone with you. Like, the world's not going to burn down. Just take a few moments screen free with her." But she also was like, this is right when she was just getting interested in my phone. And toddlers are really, really, really interested in iPhones. Mm-hmm. And so then, that afternoon, after I'd had this lovely afternoon with her, I found it in the toilet. And it had been there for it had been there for 3 hours. This was just her experimenting with the world. And I realized that my solution of just having this laissez-faire attitude of this device that she could just pick up off a coffee table was not going to work. And we were working with a nanny at the time who had this phone chain, but I think I never, you know, I think maybe I was a little snobbish to it. And I said to her, I need that. And so I ordered it. And it's actually pretty cool. It's kind of leather look. It's black. It's got a gold chain. I since discovered there is a fashion version of this, a high fashion version. There's a brand called Bandolier. And what they, the ones they make are beautiful. And I discovered this one. I was in the airport and I saw a woman carrying one. No, not surprising. She also was carrying a probably 18-month-old. I think that this is, you know, prime demographic for who the early adopters are of phone case with chain. And hers was like army green snakeskin with a contrasting strap. And I just thought like, oh, wow, this is the fashionable version of what I've been carrying around. But it also will cost you, you know, $150. And I will say, as much as I love them and they're beautiful, they have got like studs and grommets. They're very kind of rock and roll chic. The trouble is you can only fit one credit card into it. And so it's not, it's for like a night on the town, which I have very few of those. It's not for every day. And if you're going to carry your phone in it, you don't want to be swapping it out all the time. And so what I like about mine is that really my driver's license is in there. Everything that I need is in there. If anything, I wish I could put, you know, maybe a lipstick or a tube of lip gloss in it as well, but maybe it's just as well that I can't. But so there are, you know, there is the kind of top of the line, more fashionable version of it, but I happen to like the one that I've got even better. And I think right now in this particular moment, you know, again, kind of going back to what I was talking about with the, you know, why I think the ring light is so useful for people, we're stuck behind screens. And I find myself thinking so much about like, how do we recapture spontaneity and how do we recapture serendipity when we're just behind screens all the time? And maybe at least if we're mobile and moving around our houses, you've got an earbud in one ear as you're popping from calls to another, there's something nice about that. And so the mobility of something like this is part of what I like about it.
Right. So it's a phone with a, so in this particular one you're suggesting, there's a case for the phone that has a chain strap, so you carry it like a purse. But there are other versions of phone cases with straps of not just chains, but there could be leather straps. And that seems to be the larger class of the things that we're talking about, which is to turn the phone into a purse with a kind of a leather case with a strap. And whether or not you have this one, the general idea seems to be a very promising one.
I have moments where I wonder, you know, is it bad for me that I have my phone, you know, right beside my hip or abdomen all the time when I'm carrying this around? But I think most people default to either having it in their pocket or having it in, you know, their back pocket or having it in their purse. And so I don't know that it's all that different, but I have moments of wondering if this is in fact the thing, what I should be doing, but I do find it very convenient. The other thing is that, you know, if you've got a toddler, you rarely have an extra hand. And so it's just nice to, have hands that are free.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, the choice could be putting a chain on your kid to keep her from getting to your phone or putting a chain on your phone to keep your kid away from it.
Yeah, or both.
Yeah, exactly.
I think we ordered on Amazon one of those, like a little backpack for our daughter that had a spring on it, but we just couldn't get her to use. We couldn't do it.
Yeah. That's great. So what else do you have for us, Ramona?
So I've got a book that I read over the summer called The Art of the Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters by Priya Parker. And it is genius. I love talking about things that seem like they're design or things that seem like they have to do with tech, but that aren't, that are really just about social interactions. And this book to me feels so timely and so relevant to the moment. It's not explicitly about technology. It's not explicitly about design, but I would say that it should be read by technologists and designers thinking about the ways that we engage and why we engage and, you know, the, some of what's broken and the, you know, the reasons that sort of the ways that we engage with each other that may not be fulfilling our needs ultimately. You know, we spend all day, or we used to, all day in an office and in these meetings, and maybe aren't getting to the point of something, or we're in these email chains and maybe not getting accomplished what we need to. And really kind of drilling down to what we need out of each other and how we can benefit from our communities and from collaboration. And I think now we're so reliant on digital tools, and this goes back to what I was just saying about serendipity and spontaneity. I find myself thinking about this every day recently through the pandemic. We're relying on these tools all day, Zoom and you know, video chat. But they were designed before the pandemic and really without awareness of how much we would ultimately be using them, because who could have imagined this lifestyle we've been thrust into? And so, you know, we're feeling burned out. I feel like there is this sort of feeling that it's not sustainable, that it's not necessarily always enjoyable. And that shouldn't be the case. We should be able to design something bigger. And even though she's not speaking about any of that, any of that specifically, it's for people who are thinking about those kinds of things or enjoy thinking about those kinds of issues, it's such a lovely book. You know, one of the chapters that jumps out is, she talks about creating a temporary alternate world. And I've spent a lot of time in video games and alternate worlds online and studying them and making content about the medium, documentaries. And she talks just that concept, even if it's not in a virtual sense, of an alternate world as a shared experience is really incredible. She talks about designing an event as a world that will only exist once. And isn't that just like a lovely way of thinking about how people engage, that even right now we're having this shared experience that will only exist once, at least in real time as it's unfolding. In the same part, she talks about this, I would call it conflict of etiquette versus pop-up rules, where etiquette says you need to be part of this culture. You need to have been raised the right way. You need to be on the inside and know stuff, know the rules. And if you're on the outside, you're excluded from, you know, whatever particular culture's etiquette might be. Whereas pop-up rules do the opposite. They unite us. And pop-up rules is like, you know, the dîner en blanc, the dinners where everyone wears white. Or if you go to a wedding, it's so trendy nowadays, these rules that say like, okay, put your phone in the bowl when you come in. Or right. Everyone's going to bring their favorite, I guess that's nothing. That's a potluck. Everyone's going to bring their favorite dish. But these kind of rules that exist that unite people who may have nothing in common. So where etiquette feels very kind of outdated and a little passive aggressive, rules are very progressive in this sense. And, you know, we don't live in closed circles of like-minded people. We are living among people who have come from different backgrounds and have different histories and races, and having these pop-up rules as a way of uniting all of those people and making people feel like they really belong. One of the classes I'm teaching right now, just last night, I teach a class where half of the students are from Toronto or in Canadian, and half of them are from an art school in Seoul from South Korea. And just thinking through, and they're working together on creative projects. They're producing projects together. And just thinking through, there's so many differences. There's so many challenges. Language is a difference. But what are the ways that we, you know, create this temporary alternate world where we're thinking about are kind of the similarities, or we're brought into this moment, again, that notion of this moment that will only exist once together. And so there's just, it was really inspiring to read it.
That's good. Did the author make mention of the idea of the temporary autonomous zones there was a book that an author, Hakeem Bey, wrote probably 20 years ago that sounds quite similar, where you kind of set up these intentional, physical locations where you kind of have new sets of rules or guidelines, and like Burning Man is an example of that.
Right. Yeah. I don't know that she mentions that specifically, although I've just learned a new cool tool. Now I'm going to go read that. It's very much, I think, that along the same lines there is sort of the class of etiquette as an old way and the rise of this new way. That that's a little bit utopian. And isn't that, and I feel like mm-hmm. now more than ever, we see these chasms just splitting people apart. And the way that we can design experiences to bring people together, even if momentarily, feels like something we really ought to be putting a lot of energy into at the moment.
It's a time for trying new things, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned the pop-up rules, which is a nice device. Is there anything else from reading the book that you took away that you changed your own life and your own behavior based on what you read in the book for the better?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know what I will say? It's because I was reading this over the summer, and because we are living through what I think is a transformational moment in history. There's been so many changes. I mean, she talks about, she talks a lot about being really intentional about our phones and when we have them and when we don't, and when we make the choice to be very present with people and exploring the city or going on adventures with people. And I really like all of that. I really like that sort of idea of adventuring through space with people and putting people before our devices. So maybe a little bit, that's certainly, I don't know that it was an idea that I hadn't been thinking about a lot. And maybe that's why this resonated with me so much. It was a lot of ideas that I was thinking about already, but presented in such a really thoughtful and eloquent way.
And did it change your behavior? Did you change what you did because of that idea?
I try to. Here's what I'll say. When it comes to having devices around, I try to, and I aspire to be, device free more than I am. So I was inspired by it. I don't know if I've entirely changed, but I was inspired to try, definitely trying, different moments and different, sort of times of being connected or disconnected. But again, I think it's such a unique, moment in history right now that I feel like there's so many forces at play and schedules, at least in my household, schedules are so different than they were before. You know, my daughter was in daycare and isn't in daycare. And so it's just made all of our previous aspirations about our kind of balance of digital or connected or screen time or not. It's really put a lot of that in the blender for us because we're just trying to balance things as best we can where there's two people working all the time and a toddler and, there's just a big blenderization of things. But I think if we weren't living through the pandemic, I probably would have changed my ways. Is that fair to say? It's very totally. Aspirational of me, idealistic.
Totally. Yeah, that's totally fair. So you have one more book that you wanted to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Which is really related, I think. There's one book in particular, but there's also kind of a whole series of books, but there's a kid's book called Press Here. And we were given this book by three different people, which speaks to how much creative people and I think and designers like it. And this is a book that children love. My daughter loves it. But I think I would go so far, and maybe this is mommy brain of me, but I would go so far as saying I think that this book could even sit on adults' coffee tables. So Press Here is a children's book. It's very cleanly designed. It's basically just white with primary colors or black and white with primary colors. And you open up the first page and there's a yellow dot that looks like it's just kind of scribbled on with crayon and it says Press Here. And you touch it and there's nothing to it. It's a paper page. There's no batteries. There's no sounds. And when you press it, you flip to the next page and all of a sudden there's two of them. And you progress through that book that way. It asks you to turn the book upside down and all of a sudden all these little dots when you flip to the next page have fallen to the bottom of the book. And so then it asks you to turn it around. And it's as if you're manipulating the images on the page as you move through it. At a certain point, it asks you to clap and the circles get bigger or blow on them and they move to the other side of the page. And those interactions, those sort of magic moments or animations, if you would call it that, happen when you flip the page. Certainly for a little kid, it's very magical. But again, even in terms of thinking about interaction and thinking about design, it's really, really clever the way that it's been designed.
It sounds like it's almost like an iPad app, but it's a print book.
Mm-hmm. It's like an iPad app that it's like one of these iPad apps that would be designed for meditating or trying to help you relax or becoming Zen, where there's just one thing to focus on and you focus your attention on it. And then it just changes ever so slightly, goes through these different iterations as you do these very minor interactions, right? Just what it's only asking one thing of you, tap it, you know, tilt the book, blow on it a little bit, clap a little bit. And so it does, you're right, it really does feel like a very artistic Zen app, but it's a completely analog book, and it's very, very enjoyable. And my daughter always loves it. She always wants the dot book. But similarly, there's a few other that are like that, that are very tactile, very, I would call them interactive. And you know, it seems so simple. It seems so obvious to say, it maybe goes without saying that interactivity doesn't require digital tools, but look where your brain just went, right? Our brains think, oh, if it's interactive, it should be an app, and yet it doesn't need right. to be. And I love seeing human ingenuity of design and kind of user experience, if you want to call it that, but that bring you along on some kind of journey where something is engaging and gets you to engage, and you have that little thrill. Like when I see my daughter go through it, she always has this little gasp on certain pages, which is so amazing to see. But I think even, you know, for us as adults, it's really fun to go through it, and that it is tactile, and just you know, how you can design something so engaging even without the bells and whistles of our magic devices. And I love our magic devices. I mean, there's a reason that I can't put my phone down and have a chain and carry it around with me everywhere. They really are magical. But to see that same magic in a form that doesn't have, you know, that's not being supported by code, invisible code, is really interesting. And it's actually something that I've thought, I didn't do it, but I've thought about even including this in some of the classes that I teach sometimes as something that people should look at as an example of design.
That sounds great. So Press Here, it's called, and mm-hmm. it's about $20 for the book, it looks like.
It's a great, and yeah, so if you ever need to give someone with a little kid or someone who's expecting a book, it's really good, especially if you are worried about not wanting to give like Peppa Pig or something that's branded or something right. that, you know, you don't know if they're going to like. I feel like most, this feels like a very safe gift to give your friends if they've got kids because it is so aesthetic and it is so nicely designed. Maybe that's why we ended up with three of them.
That's great. So we have a few minutes left, Ramon, and I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. Tell us about something that you're involved with, the recovery cohort.
Sure. So I'm a professor at Ryerson University in Toronto, which has, you know, a very established school of media and school of journalism. And I run something called the Creative Innovation Studio, which is home to a series or a network of incubators. But not your average startup incubator. They're incubators for innovation within the creative industries. So there's an incubator focused on media, one on fashion, and one on design fabrication, which is like interior design, robotics, makery stuff, architecture. Very cool. It's an amazing space to get to be in and imagine in and try and grow. And bridges academia and industry, but very much focused on craft and creation. And so this mm-hmm. fall, you know, we're entirely online. Universities in Canada are entirely online right now. Mm-hmm. Next semester, even in the winter, we're going to stay online. And that's challenging enough when you're just teaching a class. But to think of an incubator space where it's really about that peer-to-peer experience, it's about being together and seeing what people who may be working on totally different kinds of projects, but who are, you know, like-minded in that they're really innovative, maybe they're entrepreneurial, they have a lot of creative agency, just to be in that same space. And so all of a sudden, when that's remote or when that's exclusively online, it's very challenging. And so we took that challenge and sort of responded to challenge by wanting to fix some of those challenges. So what or respond to some of those issues that we're all grappling with right now. So in response to the pandemic, and what I would call like three intersecting emergencies, right? There's this health emergency we're in the midst of, a social one, and this push for social reform or social evolution, social justice, and also environmental, right? Like just in the back of my mind is this dread that we're going to get through COVID-19 and then we're not going to be able to go out in the summers because the sidewalks are going to be melting. And so we're running this special program called the Recovery Cohort, which is focused on rebuilding and reimagining the creative industries. So rebuilding is like, I don't think a lot of people are thinking about the fact that there's not going to be new shows to watch because for a great stretch of time, things haven't been in production. Shows require a lot of people on set. You know, what does the future of concerts look like or theatrical shows? Here in Toronto, there was a few of the, you know, the big classic theaters that were just about to reopen with socially distanced shows. And just today, we're entering into, it's stage two, it's called here, but another lockdown where, you know, theaters are not going to be able to be open for the next 28 days. And so creators are really hurting. You know, creators often aren't that financially stable to start out with. And so this is looking at how do we rebuild, but also acknowledging that it's not like there weren't flaws in these systems already. And so how can we make them more equitable? And how can we make these processes of creation more sustainable? So that's really, really exciting, is to be working with creators who are seeing this moment and seeing an opportunity to reimagine and rebuild.
That sounds great. Very cool. Mm-hmm. I would love to, once things open up, visit that again once it becomes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'd love to have you. Mm-hmm.
Sounds great. So tell us about the other project you're working on with GANS.
Oh, yes. So I will admit I'm pretty new to this space. So GANS stands for Generative Adversarial Networks. And so this is, you know, using AI for content creation or image creation. And so for people who are not familiar with this, I would say go to the website, thispersondoesnotexist.com. Have you been there? Have you seen this?
Yeah, I have been. Yeah, that's really cool. Yes. It's like stock photos of people who aren't really there.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I can't shake this feeling that for so long we thought that, computer generated images that as the, you know, uncanny valley got narrower and narrower, it would be kind of that final fantasy CG, those kind of designs that would get more and more and more realistic. And I feel like these GANs just kind of came out of left field and T-boned us as we were going along this other path in terms of fabricated generative faces or content that looks real, that fools the eye and yet isn't. And so it's really fascinating to me. I'm working on a project right now. We're just in the early stages of it, but playing with nostalgia and cinema and the kind of narratives that have shaped Hollywood and, you know, Hollywood movie posters. And what's exciting to me about it, or what's really interesting to me about it is, you know, there's science fiction and so much of classic science fiction and those narratives and the imagery is like metallic robots, kind of humanoid robots. And if you think about what GANs are, they're totally invisible robots, right? Like you don't see them, but they're crafting images. And to think about them crafting humanoid images based on, you know, a lot of images from our narrative history, kind of the history of cinema and those images, just feels like it's these two things coming head to head. Mainstream narratives based on this human tradition and how those get reimagined by an AI creatively. And part of the reason that I'm exploring this right now is, well, I'm teaching a class called Virtual Identities and Communities. And it felt like we're at the stage now where, you know, where we can talk about performative spaces like TikTok and YouTube and Facebook and Instagram. And we can talk about virtual worlds and virtual spaces like, you know, Animal Crossing or Second Life or World of Warcraft. But then there's all these bots and there's that makes, and there's all this AI and that makes that really also influences the spaces that we engage in online. And so I started digging into all of this because I wanted to really build that into the course robustly. But as a creator, I also started feeling this pressure to start exploring in this space, because I feel like we're at a stage with artificial intelligence and machine learning as tools for creation. It feels like we're at a stage now where right when Photoshop was starting to be used, I wish I could pinpoint the time a little bit better. I could have just done a quick Google search, but I'm going to guess like 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago, when people just started working with Photoshop, it wasn't something that was part of everyone's practice. And yet now it really is. If you're an artist or a creator, it's a tool that you use. Any ad agency, right? Anyone in the creative industries is using a tool like Photoshop. I think it's even become a verb, right? Something is Photoshopped. It looks Photoshopped. Is that image online? Is that Instagram Photoshopped, right? It's so much part of the lexicon. And I think looking forward, I don't think that the timeline is even as long. I think probably even within the next decade, it's really going to be a part of how we create content and how images are made and created. And so, yeah, I just felt this intense pressure, I think, to start playing with these tools as a creator in that way. So that's really exciting.
You might want to look at Art Breeder, which is an accessible way to breed, using AI to breed new images based on two previous images. And you have the whole descendants, and you can go through in a kind of a breeding way. It's kind of a tool for making portraits, landscapes, album covers, things like that.
Oh, that's really neat.
I think if you Google Art Breeder, it should turn up. Ramona, it's really been great. I really enjoyed hearing your take on technology, because I think it's really, really important that we keep in mind ways in which we can civilize all these tools. And thank you for your fantastic choices of tools, ring lights and things like that. I think are really cool that people should know about. I appreciate your turning us on to some things that we didn't know about.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. I look forward to seeing photos of both of you with your new phone cases strapped around your shoulders.
Can't wait. Yeah. And ring lights to illuminate ourselves.
Great.
Yeah.
Ramona, this has been a blast talking to you and finding out all the things you're working on. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been so much fun. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, everybody. It's your host, Mark, and I wanted to thank you for listening to The Cool Tools Show. And I also wanted to let you know that we've got a lot more going on at Cool Tools than just this podcast. We also have the Cool Tools website, which has a new tool review every day, and you can get there by going to cool-tools.org. We also have 4 different newsletters that you can subscribe to, and you can subscribe to those from the Cool Tools page. We have this podcast that you're listening to right now. We also have a YouTube channel where we review tools. Check that YouTube channel out by going to youtube.com/cooltools. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is, if you're really enjoying everything that we are producing, go to our Patreon page and support us there. You can sign up and give us as little as $1 a month, and that would mean a lot to us. The money that we get from Patreon goes towards a lot of things. We transcribe our podcast interviews so that you can read them online. We pay for editing of our podcasts and for our videos. We pay our contributors. We have video production costs. We have equipment costs. We have hosting costs. And the money you give us through Patreon also goes to support Cool Tools Lab. Anything you give is a huge help. And one of the things that we do is, if you are a contributor to Patreon, we'll give you a shout out on air. And so I have a few people here to thank this week. Mark Lyonage, Micah Gates, Monty Zukowski, Patrick James McNally, Robert Cohen, Scott, Spence Lloyd, Steve Avery, Steve Golden, Steve Levine, Tom Hess, William Phillips, Aaron Nipper, Dharab Patel, Glenn Mercer, Jay Walker, Jeff Bonaire, Ryan Jarrell, Pat Daly, Patrick Kennedy, Troy Wallett, Mike Camerate, Nicole Harkin, Tim Youssef, Scott Reed. Thanks all of you for supporting Cool Tools. And if you would like to have a shout out, go over to the Patreon page and sign up. And thanks for listening to the Cool Tools podcast. We'll see you next week.